Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather around the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harris, and it's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, and its host and founder is Carol Marks. Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Okay, we have a really good show for you today. A very, very special guest, a legend indeed, 96-year-old Carl Reiner, American comedian, actor, director, and writer whose career spans seven decades. Carl Reiner became the oldest ever nominee for an Emmy Award in July for his role, appropriately enough, narrating and appearing in the HBO documentary, If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast, about people staying active into their 90s and beyond.
Now, before we talk about your latest Emmy nomination, you've already won 9. And if you win this one, you'll also make the Guinness Book of Records for being the oldest Emmy recipient. 51 years ago, you won your first Emmy Best Supporting Actor for Caesar's Hour. What was your reaction to winning that award?
I remember saying it. I said, there must be some mistake because there was some very good competition. By the way, I have 12 Emmys. There were 3 I got for producing and another one we did. There were three other Emmys I got, and I was very happy to get them because I have 3 kids, and I can each get 4 this way.
Yeah, wonderful. And I want to jump now to your present Emmy nomination, which is for an HBO documentary, If You're in the Orbit, Eat Breakfast. And that came out on HBO in 2017. And I want to ask you, who came up with the idea? What was his motive? And how
This is so clear in my mind to this day. The idea came from the brain of my wife's nephew, George Shapiro, who is my nephew-in-law and also my manager. And he's the producer of the Seinfeld show. He's one of the brightest men I know and a go-getter. And he went and got me. And he said he's doing a show. He had the show called that he started doing was Vital After 90. And the idea was he noticed that so many people were still doing what they were doing all their lives, and they were in their 90s. And he went all over the world finding people who were doing it. He found a marathon woman who ran marathons at 100, and he had pictures of her, you know, interviewing her. They were artists and painters and all kinds of people. And one of them he came to work because I was still working at 90. He interviewed me. And the title was something that somebody imposed on the thing. It was called Vital at 90, really. And when they came to my house, I mentioned the fact that the first thing I do every morning when I come down is before I have breakfast, I will read the obits in the newspaper. And if I'm not in the obit, I'll have breakfast. So that I said
it.
That. And some producer of who produced that whole thing said, that's a good title. Let's use that. So really, the original title was Vital at 90, but this is the superimposed title. And I'm very happy they used it.
What made you say, because in this documentary you introduce so many famous people, what made you say that you have really been an MC introducing people all your life?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's one of the pleasures of all my life. From the very beginning when I was very young, I had the gift of not preparing things, but introducing people as an MC and finding words to say on my feet while I was doing it. And it was one of the things I did for years. I did the Directors Guild for 25 years. I did the Writers Guild for a number of years. I did a number of shows as an MC. And it came very easy to me, and that's one of the things I love doing, because you're the one who said, hey, this guy is Luciano Pavarotti, listen to him. And you're the one who said, listen to this brilliant tenor sing. And so you're always involved in it. Everybody who ever recommends something that you see or do, and you see it and love it, you always thank the person for reminding you or telling you about it.
Boy, you were so right. Absolutely. And I want to talk about two of the oh-so-talented older Americans that are in this documentary. And I want to talk about first Dick Van Dyke, still a very good friend. Why do you say that the Dick Van Dyke Show will always be your best work?
Well, I said that if I have been asked many times, what am I most proud of? And I say, hands down, my work on the Dick Van Dyke Show, because that one was a labor of love, because it came from my gut. It was about my family superimposed into a show called the Dick Van Dyke Show. By the way, I insist on calling it the Dick Van Dyke Show. Originally, I had done it for myself called Head of the Family. When I finished with the show of shows, somebody was offering me situation comedies, and they weren't very good. My wife said, why don't you write one? And so one summer on Fire Island, I wrote 13 episodes of the called Head of the Family, and I got it sponsored by, backed by Peter Lawford, put up the money for the pilot. It was okay. I did it with Barbara Britton, and it wasn't very good. And I decided to go on and do other things, and somebody gave these 13 scripts to Danny Thomas and Sheldon Leonard, and they called me in and said, hey, these are wonderful. I said, Sheldon, I don't want to fail with the same material twice. He said, you won't fail. We'll get a better actor to play you. And he recommended Dick Van Dyke, and I went to New York, and I saw Bye Bye Birdie with him and Chita Rivera, and I saw there one of the most talented human beings I've ever seen, multi-talented, sang, danced, charmed. He's to this day, by the way, Steve Martin the other day said the single most talented man in all of show business is Dick Van Dyke, and I concur. I really think so.
And that's a wonderful compliment. Now, every year on CBS, you pick out two of your favorite Dick Van Dyke shows that have been redone in color, which is so great. And this year they're going to air on Friday, December 14th at 9 p.m., and the shows are Where Did I Come From and Never Bathe on Saturday. So what are they about, and why did you pick these two shows?
Well, I didn't particularly pick them. It was sort of the guy who's been handling the distribution of it. He decided that might be them. And he asked me, and I said, yeah, they're fine. Listen, I have 158 of them, and I could have picked any two. All of the shows we did were worth doing, except one, and I won't tell you which one. But all of them are worthy of colorization. As a matter of fact, at one point we thought of colorizing all the shows, but they were prohibitive in price, and we wouldn't have had a profit at the beginning. So,
well,
but
those
shows are good, wonderful examples. Especially you never bathe on Sunday, because Mary is so charming and so is Dick.
Now, I got to ask you about writing scripts for Dick Van Dyke. Was that a little hard, because he expresses his emotions with wild, really uncanny physical moves rather than using words? Was that kind of a challenge?
Well, he overlaid the character of Rob Petrie with an image that I never saw. I mean, when I did it, I couldn't possibly do any of that stuff. And he gave it a dimension that nobody can touch. To this day, he still moves like that. He can still do that. It's a gift. He's an extraordinary performer. And as a matter of fact, he's doing something in Mary Poppins again, the new Mary Poppins. He's still dancing on rooftops.
And he's dancing in the film. I mean, that is absolutely incredible and wonderful. Now, there's another icon in the HBO documentary that you narrated that I want to talk a little bit about, and that's Mel Brooks, such a very dear friend of yours. Why do you say and have said that he is the funniest man on earth?
There's no question about it. I met Mel Brooks when I first came to do the show of shows. Mel wasn't even on the staff then. He was working for Sid, giving him jokes for a few dollars. He'd give him some jokes. And the first day I walked in, I didn't know who he was. And he was standing in a corner and talking. And he was doing a Jewish pirate. I never forget. He's a Jewish pirate saying, "You know how hard it is to set sail today? You know what they're charging for sailcloth? $3.29 a yard. I can't afford to pillage and rape anymore." That's the first words came out of his mouth. And the following day, the following week, on a Monday, Sunday, I saw We the People Speak, where it was an interview show. And I, without saying anything, I said to him, I said, "Here's a man who's 2,000 years old and actually knew Jesus." I just said that to him. He didn't bat an eyelash. He says, "Thin lad, right? You know Jesus, thin lad, right?" He always wore sandals, walked with 12 other guys. They came into the store, had a candy store. They never bought anything, but they asked for water. I gave them water. They were nice boys. That was the first thing we ever said. And then for the next 6 years, 5 years, at parties, when there was a lull in the office, I would start asking the 2,000-year-old man questions that would pop in my head, and he would give me such answers that I had to bite my lip not to laugh on when we started recording it, because he surprised him. I think he surprised himself, too, but they were extraordinary.
Well,
we did five records.
Fun you had, and I understand that Cary Grant heard your routine. And
yes.
He just loved it so much he made it popular in Europe by playing it for the Queen Mother. My goodness.
Yes, that's right. We had bungalows next to each other at Universal where I was making movies. And I met him one day, and the album just came out, and we weren't sure how it was going to play for other people. And I gave him one, and he came back, and he said, "Can I only have a dozen?" I said, "What are you going to do?" He said, "I'm taking them going to London." I said, "You going to take these to England?" He said, "They speak English there, you know." And he came back, and we worried about that. The jokes were for Jews and non-anti-Semitic Gentiles. But he said she loved it, and that was. I said, "Who?" He says, "We took it to the palace." I thought he was at the Palace Theater. No, he said, "Took the Queen Mother." And I said, "Then if the biggest chicks in the world loved it, then we're home free."
Absolutely, and. Talking about the album that you have made for the 2,000-year-old man with Mel Brooks, are people still buying them?
Oh, yes. There's a company that that puts them all out in partnership with us. I forgot the name of the company. That was terrible. But they come out, that they're so whole. They keep them all together, five or six in a set.
Well,
yeah,
now we've got Google. All people will have to do is put it in Google and ask where they can find them. Now, you have said, Carl, that
The Shout Factory. The Shout Factory, I think, is the one who's
Oh, wow. Now, you have said that your goal is always to have new goals. So when it comes to aging, why do you say you keep on typing? What have you been pounding out on your typewriter? And what projects are you working on?
Oh, right now I have a couple of projects. As a matter of fact, there are three or four books coming out. One is a book on radio, which is just finished. It's the history of radio from the time I was a little kid listening to radio. And the first movie, the two movie books, the first movie I saw when I was 4 years old, my folks took me to the movie, going through all the movies I saw right through the war and past the war, to the present day, movies I've seen and viewed and some I've done, you know, actually the director acted in. And so those are two movie books that I've done. And then I did a book on radio, which was really one of my favorites because my father built a little crystal set when I was 4 or 5 years old, and I heard these scratchy music shows and static coming on the radio, and that's a very interesting book. It ends with a very funny thing because at the end of the radio book, I have a picture of, what's her name, Hedy Lamarr. And I said, somebody said, what is Hedy Lamarr doing? I said, people are going to ask, what is Hedy Lamarr doing? I said, because of Hedy Lamarr, she's an inventor, you know. She invented the spread spectrum, which gave us hi-fi, and which without that kind of invention and knowledge, the cell phone wouldn't exist today. So we
amazing.
Have Hedy Lamarr to thank for that.
She was beautiful. You know, one of the books that you wrote, I just love the title because it says everything about you because the title of the book is Too Busy to Die. And that's all about being active and doing things. And
yes.
So important. And finally, I want to ask you, in narrating the HBO documentary, If You're Not in the Orbit, Eat Breakfast, it's going to come out on DVD on December 10th. And was there something that struck you about all the performers that you introduced that you felt helped them age well and retain their vitality? My goodness.
You know, the idea for that show was my nephew's idea. My wife's nephew, my nephew-in-law, who's also my manager, George Shapiro, had an idea for a show, a brilliant idea for a show, which is called Vital at 90. And he came to me because I was still vital at 90 and did a little interview with me, and that's on the cassette. But it was one of the really great ideas because he went all over the world and interviewed people who were 90 and still doing it. A marathon runner, a woman, 100 still running marathons, artists still painting portraits at 90. And the interesting thing was that somebody saw my little thing that I actually said this one morning to myself. Before I eat breakfast, I read the obits. If I'm not in it, I'll have breakfast. I once said that, and somebody picked that up, and whoever put this whole little package together decided that would be a good title. So I accept the fact that it's a good title, but all the credit for the idea of it should go to George, who came up with that concept.
And just a few of the great people you have that you introduce in that film are, besides Dick Van Dyke and Mel Brooks, just a few of them are Norman Lear and Betty White and Tony Bennett and Stan Lee and Kirk Douglas. And, you know, it's just remarkable that they're still going strong. And I think a lot of it has to do with having a good attitude when you're getting older. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's it. My whole idea when I wrote this crazy book, How to Live Forever, which is you get out of bed, you start a project, work on the project, improve it, and when it's improved, start a new project. For 270-word pages, I just say that. That's the only thing on the 270. I just repeat it, and that is exactly the truth. If you get up and have something to do, you have to stay alive to do it.
Absolutely. And I also want to remind our listeners that the third annual Dick Van Dyke Show, Now a Living Cover, is going to air on Friday, December 14th at 9 p.m. on CBS. And Carl Reiner, I have so enjoyed talking to you today on the show. Thank you for bringing so much humor into our lives because I think it helps us get through difficult times by looking at the challenges we all are facing in a different, non-threatening way. And keep up your Twitter tweets, and you have to stick around. Be active and happy with your many friends and family until 2020 because, as you say, you've got to vote in the next election. And I love your determination. God bless you.
Thank you.
Now, there is a true legend. Carl Reiner is, without question, one of the most influential people when it comes to setting the course of comedy from the mid-20th century until the present day and obviously beyond. Carl Reiner in conversation with the host of our program, Carol Marks, an American comedian, actor, director, and writer. His career spans 7 decades, and he became the oldest ever nominee for an Emmy Award in July for his role in narrating and appearing in the HBO documentary If You're Not in the Obit, Eat Breakfast, about people staying active into their 90s and beyond. Good job, Carol Marks. Carl Reiner on A Touch of Gray. Coming up next, James R. Hansen, Professor Emeritus of History at Auburn University, talking about Neil Armstrong. That's next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues on this great talk radio station.
Back pain doesn't take vacations. It never celebrates holidays. It's on the job 24/7 to keep your life exactly where it is, in limbo. But it doesn't have to be that way, because Laser Spine Institute can help you take back your life from chronic neck and back pain. With a less than 1-inch incision, our minimally invasive procedures have provided relief to over 60,000 patients with a 97% patient satisfaction rate. So get ready to stand tall and live the life you've imagined for yourself without pain. Are you or a loved one suffering from a bulging disc, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, pinched nerve, or degenerative disc disease? Call our spine care consultants now for a no-cost MRI review and to learn more. It's time to say goodbye to chronic neck and back pain. What have you got to lose? Laser Spine Institute, the leader in minimally invasive spine surgery.
Call 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK. That's 855-730-BACK.
Hi, this is Michael Harrison. I hope you're enjoying this installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, and finding it to be a meaningful listening experience. This wonderful little weekend program has been on the radio across America in one form or another for more than 20 years. Its mission is to provide mature Americans with information and content about aging to help them cope with the nonstop challenges of life during these hectic modern times. We're talking about health, finances, relationships, and plain old fun. Whether it's learning about the latest technology and social norms, or fondly remembering yesterday's arts and entertainment, A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, is dedicated to serving that gigantic segment of the population so sadly ignored by most of today's popular media. Founded and hosted by a truly great lady, Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the ongoing battle against ageism, this program is geared to what has commonly been referred to as the sandwich generation. Baby boomers who are coping with such challenges as still supporting their adult children while caring for their elderly parents. It's my honor and privilege to be associated with Carol Marks and be a part of her mission to support, defend, and inspire today's generation of what she lovingly calls seasoned citizens. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, online at www.atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. And right here on this great radio station every weekend. Thank you so much for listening.
This is Brad Shepard. Whenever you think of Social Security, do you think of survivors' benefits too? You see, Social Security is more than retirement. Social Security makes regular monthly payments to the families of workers who die too. More than 7 million people get survivors' benefits from Social Security, including almost 2 million children. Benefits that pay for food and clothing, medical care, and school benefits you can count on when you're planning your financial future. For more information, go to the SSA website at www.ssa.gov.
Michael Harrison here. Those of you who follow talk radio and are interested in what goes on behind the scenes might also know me as the publisher of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication that serves the talk media industry. We cover the talk show business as it exists on radio, television, and the Internet. I often have the opportunity to speak about these media as a guest on radio and TV talk shows or comment on industry developments in newspapers and magazines. For the past 3 years, I've also hosted a weekly podcast that features interviews with fascinating people from a variety of fields and walks of life. It's designed to be enjoyed by media freaks, pop culture aficionados, political junkies, and the philosophically curious. Recent guests include such interesting folks as former U.S. Senator Joe Lieberman, Richard Nixon's grandson Christopher Nixon Cox, Alex Jones, Freddie Boom Boom Cannon, Deepak Chopra, Dr. Alan Stern, the principal investigator of NASA's New Horizons Pluto mission, radio broadcasters Sean Hannity, Mike Francesa, and Joe Piscopo, and legendary WWE ring announcer Lillian Garcia. How's that for variety? Each week, I interview outstanding personalities from the world of radio or any number of its related fields in the arts, science, entertainment, politics, or academia. It's available to download, and you can subscribe to it at absolutely no charge whatsoever at Apple Podcasts or at the website mhinterview.com. The Michael Harrison Interview. Just a click away on your computer or mobile device. Visit Apple Podcasts or mhinterview.com. Make the Michael Harrison Interview a weekly podcast listening experience. This week on the Michael Harrison Interview, you'll hear a conversation with the executive editor of the Washington Examiner, Hugo Gurdon.
Don't do what I did and run out. If it's working, don't quit. Why would you stop? Why undo all the good that's been accomplished?
You've got to feed them right for life.
Dynavite is nutrition.
If I ever took Roy off of Dynavite.
No.
When I get to about 3/4.
When I get down to the bottom of my box of Dynavite.
Oh, no. I've got a couple more scoops.
It's time to place my order. Dynavite.com.
Dinovite.com.
859-428-1000.
Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite for your dog this week.
We'll send you 4 extra packs of Nubba Nubs. Free.
Nubba Nub treats are freeze-dried beefy treats.
Made with no cereal fillers, chemical preservatives, or dyes.
Good for the tummy.
And yummy.
Nubba Nub treats.
Free this week at Dynavite.com.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite.
Dynavite for life.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dinovite.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Here again is the host of our program, Carol Marks, in conversation now with James R. Hansen. He's a professor emeritus of history at Auburn University. A former historian for NASA, he's the author of 12 books on the history of aerospace and a 2-time nominee for the Pulitzer Prize in History. He wrote the book First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, published by Simon & Schuster, and served as co-producer of the recently released major motion picture First Man, based on this New York Times best-selling biography.
Now, what motivated you to write a biography about Neil Armstrong, and what effect did seeing the landing on the moon have on you? I understand you took Polaroid pictures of it.
Yeah, I did. You know, this was back long before the VCR or the DVR, and the only way you could get any image off of a television was to, you know, sit in front of it with a photographic camera and take pictures of it. So, yeah, I took a number of pictures of the TV screen, and And so that's my record. And I certainly remember the moon landing. I was between my junior and senior year of high school preparing for college entrance examinations. But I was glued to the television that Sunday, July 20th, like millions and millions of other people all around the world.
Now, can you tell our listeners, Jim, what kind of unbelievable access you had to Neil Armstrong's personal life, family, his training in the Air Force, as well as fascinating new glimpses into what went on during Apollo 11's landing on the moon?
Well, I was very, very lucky because a number of writers had approached Armstrong about writing his life story, and I guess I just caught him at the right time, both for him and for me. I was about 20 years into my career as an aerospace historian at the time, and so I had a kind of a track record of the kinds of books I would write. And Neil knew from those books that I would take his engineering side seriously and not just, you know, sensationalize story or just focus on his years as an astronaut. He was a very remarkable character whose career as a test pilot and as a naval aviator was, you know, fascinating in and of itself. And so I just kind of caught him at the right time. I think he had just turned 70 years old and was disengaging from a lot of his business responsibilities at that point, and his family had been encouraging him to let some writer do this with him. And so I ended up having 55 hours of tape recorded interview with him over many, many months, and that access to him also encouraged access to, you know, his brother and his sister, and his sister made all kinds of family papers available to me, and I talked to people, you know, people who grew up with him as a boy and who went to school with him in college and who flew with him in the Navy, and fellow astronauts, of course. And so it was an incredible once-in-a-lifetime experience for me, and I knew it was not going to happen again, that the access that Neil was giving me, it was never going to happen for anyone else again. This was, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for everybody. So I did everything I could to take advantage of it and tell the story as well as I could.
Now, they say you can't fully understand an adult if you don't know their childhood. Any idea about his family life and social background were that helped contribute to Neil's really growing up to be an introverted geek who loved science and flying and didn't talk about his personal life?
Yeah, I agree with you completely. I think it's a Wordsworth poem that says the child is the father to the man. And certainly as a biographer, I feel strongly that without understanding the formative experiences, the parents, the siblings, the community, the family, the everything about the growing up, that you really don't fathom the personality, as an adult. And so, yeah, I spent a lot of time, trying to understand, and explore Neil's, his youth and his growing up. And I think, he was a firstborn child. His parents were both they were all from farming families in northwestern Ohio, and so they were very simple kind of people with farming backgrounds, rural. Neither one of his parents went to college. His father was an accountant that got a job working for the state of Ohio that audited the books of various counties, which moved the family around a lot. I think that one of the formative experiences was that Neil lived probably in six different small towns in Ohio by the time he was 10 years old. And so he learned how to get along on his own, as a firstborn child. He would then have a sister that's 2 years younger and a brother 4 years younger. But, and Neil's relationship with his mother in particular in her eyes, Neil couldn't do anything wrong. And she was a very devout evangelical Christian woman who tried to raise her family that way. And and one of the more interesting things about Neil is that religious education the way he was brought up didn't really take with him quite too much. And he was not ever the argumentative type. When his mother talked about religion, Neil would listen politely, not say anything, and then just walk away. And that became a very fundamental aspect of his personality, because everybody I interviewed, I asked if they'd ever seen Neil argue with anyone, and the answer was always no, that wasn't what he did. He just listened, and he may very well not have agreed with you, but he kept that disagreement to himself and just went and did, you know, and did things the way he thought was best. And so there was a lot about him, I think, that he kept to himself. And I think it does go back to this very loving relationship with a mother that he, you know, he loved and loved so much, but didn't really agree with her on certain things. And he just decided he'd keep those elements of his personality and his thinking to himself.
Now, of course, I also think that one reason he didn't talk about his personal life was that he really experienced so much heartache. Can you tell our listeners about having to bury his own 2-year-old daughter, Karen, in 1962, who died from a fall-induced concussion? That was just before he enrolled in the astronaut program, and the near deaths he experienced in space, and the death of his closest friends in the space program. Now, one was Ed White, and who was the other one?
Well, he made good friends with Elliot C., who was also part of the second class of astronauts, along with Ed White, and that was Neil's group that came into NASA in September 1962. But yes, just previous to entering his name into astronaut selection, the family had lost their little girl, Karen, from a brain tumor that had, the diagnosis had stemmed from a fall in a park, which had a concussion involved, but then they found out that she was really suffering from this malignant brain tumor, and so she died at age 2.5, and that was the worst loss that any family can undergo, and it really stresses a lot of marriages, and it stressed Neil and Janet, and Neil was the sort of person that he'd never, it was funny, not only did he not talk about the death of the child with friends, or even other family members, but he didn't talk about it with his wife. I mean, she needed to talk to him about it, but he just kept that so locked up. And then, of course, he lost a lot more in the incoming years. I mean, not just fellow astronauts, but people that really have become very, very close friends within the astronaut corps. So there was a lot of grief that Neil had to work through, and I think going to the moon was part of the process by which he did work through it well.
Now let's go to that amazing adventure of the Apollo 11 spacecraft, Columbia, and its lunar model, the Eagle. Now, it landed on the moon with Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin at the controls. Wasn't that a scary moment when Neil Armstrong had to go to a different landing area than he thought he was going to land on? And I would think that would have been kind of upsetting.
Well, yeah, the onboard computer was heading them down to a place on the surface of the moon that was not quite the best place to go. It was full of boulders the size of Volkswagens and some large craters, and it was really just that the onboard computer had some issues that, you know, were taking them down in the wrong place. So Neil took over manually from the computer and flew the machine in a way that no one expected him that he would have to do. It was, I mean, the machine was capable of doing it, but no one expected it to be flown that way. So he had to fly it kind of vertically like a helicopter over those fields until he found a smoother spot. And what caused why that was an issue was that landing module, the Eagle, only had so much fuel. And they got very, very close to using up all of the fuel before he could land. And so, yeah, it got pretty dicey there for a while.
I would say so. And I was really intrigued by what you wrote about the relationship between Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong when they were on that moon landing. So why did the third astronaut on the voyage, Michael Collins, say that really they were amiable strangers, not very close?
Yeah. Mike Collins is one of the wittiest and most incisive commentators on the space program in general. And so when I interviewed him for the book, you know, he described his crew, the Apollo 11 crew, as amiable strangers, the three of them. And very apt description. But then I asked him, well, what about just Neil and Buzz? what about them? And he thought for a moment, and Mike told me, neutral strangers. So that was to have the first two men on the moon come down together and that are all forever historically, you know, together as the as a duo of exploration, to have them being neutral strangers is really pretty unusual. And I mean, they worked very well together professionally. And that, I think, was the key to for Neil. I mean, Neil was okay with Buzz and knew that Buzz was a very proficient astronaut. But there were certain aspects of Buzz's personality and of Neil's personality that made it hard for the two of them to really bond as friends. And so they really never became friends, not even later in life. But when they had to do their job together, they both did what they needed to do very well.
Now, I want to ask you about Neil Armstrong getting to be the first astronaut to get out of the Eagle and walk on the moon. And in your book, you talked a little bit about the fact that Buzz Aldrin was upset that he wasn't the one to first go down the ladder. So how did that happen? And how did Neil get to go down that ladder first?
Yeah, well, that's I do have a chapter in the book called First Out, and it looks at this issue in detail. And the thing was, when the first landing took place, or when they were planning for it, they really weren't sure the best way for the, you know, given the interior layout of the lunar module, there were some questions as to what would be best in terms of which astronaut went out first, just for the safety inside of the front of the lunar module. And in the Gemini program that preceded Apollo, the second astronaut, not the commander, but the other crew member, was the one that always made the spacewalk, and the commander stayed in the spacecraft. Of course, it was still flying in space at that point. But anyway, when Apollo came around, based on the Gemini precedent, they thought, well, maybe that'll be the same thing. Maybe it'll be the number two guy that goes out and the commander will stay in the spacecraft. But there was a big difference. In Apollo, that spacecraft has landed. It's not flying anymore. And so at first NASA was a little coy about, you know, they weren't sure exactly. And it took them a few months after they named the Apollo 11 crew to actually announce that Armstrong would be going out first. And it was partly related to the interior layout of the LEM and how the hatch opened and how it was easier for Neil to get out first. But it was really more of a political, public relations sort of thing, because Armstrong, they knew, the men in charge of the space program knew these two guys pretty well. And they knew that the man who became the first man on the moon was going to be a global icon and celebrity and world famous and, you know, and was going to be in a very special historical role. And they knew that Neil was the sort of man, very modest, no ego, very much a Charles Lindbergh type of personality. They just felt that he, rather than Buzz, was better suited for this historical role. And so that decision was really made behind the scenes, and NASA never announced it in that way. But I've got good source from my oral history interviews that meeting really took place. And so it was a combination of factors, but I think they just felt that Neil would really represent NASA and the United States and all mankind in terms of fulfilling this role of first man.
You're listening to a conversation between the host of our program, Carol Marks, and James R. Hansen, Professor Emeritus of History at Auburn University. A former historian for NASA, Hansen is the author of 12 books on the history of aerospace and a two-time nominee for the Pulitzer Prize in History. His 1995 book, Spaceflight Revolution, was nominated for the Pulitzer by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the only time NASA ever nominated a book for the prize. He served as co-producer of the recently released major motion picture First Man, which is based on his New York Times best-selling biography of Neil Armstrong, First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, published by Simon & Schuster. We'll have the final segment of the conversation between James R. Hansen and Carol Marks when A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment. We'll be right back.
get the stinky dog away from me.
Bad breath and bad gas.
Petey stopped eating. All his hair fell out.
Itching, licking, missing fur.
At least $5,000 in vet bills.
Creams, antibiotics, sprays.
No results.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
D-I-N-O-V-I-T-E .com.
If you want the dog to be healthy, you got to feed it something healthy.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Dynavite is nutrition.
The shedding has stopped and the itching has stopped.
Her coat is not soft. It's silky. It's healthy and shiny and glossy.
She's got life. She's got energy.
Tons of energy. No more bad smells.
Dynavite's the bomb.
Dynavite is the best thing that's ever happened to my dogs, you know, besides me, of course.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
Dynavite for life.
D-I-N-O-V-I-T-E .com.
Bernadette Duncan spent 26 years as a radio talk show producer. In her new book, Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, she shares her adventures in the trenches of big-time talk radio during the changing backdrop of America's pre- and post-9/11 realities. This exciting story includes Bernadette's impressions of the quirky celebrity talk show hosts whom she served during her career, Larry King, Sally Jesse Raphael, Gil Gross, Tom Snyder, Lou Dobbs, Charles Osgood, and more. It's full of anecdotes about hundreds of high-profile guests from media, show business, and politics. Also quirky, ego-driven, and neurotic. Yappy Days, Behind the Scenes with Newsers, Schmoozers, Boozers, and Losers, an analytical look at the media, journalism, and the complex nature of ego. Get it now at Amazon.com.
Back pain doesn't take vacations. It never celebrates holidays. It's on the job 24/7 to keep your life exactly where it is, in limbo. But it doesn't have to be that way, because Laser Spine Institute can help you take back your life from chronic neck and back pain. With a less than 1-inch incision, our minimally invasive procedures have provided relief to over 60,000 patients with a 97% patient satisfaction rate. So get ready to stand tall and live the life you've imagined for yourself without pain. Are you or a loved one suffering from a bulging disc, herniated disc, spinal stenosis, pinched nerve, or degenerative disc disease? Call our spine care consultants now for a no-cost MRI review and to learn more. It's time to say goodbye to chronic neck and back pain. What have you got to lose? Laser Spine Institute, the leader in minimally invasive spine surgery.
Call 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK, 855-730-BACK. That's 855-730-BACK.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. Let's get into the final segment of this hour of our broadcast and the concluding segment of Carol Mark's interview with James R. Hansen, author of First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, published by Simon & Schuster.
And, you know, and I was really surprised to learn that really after the Apollo 11 mission that Neil Armstrong really displayed absolutely no ego at all. And how did he handle, in general, that extraordinary amount of publicity that followed him for the rest of his life?
Well, he tried everything he could to lead as normal a life as possible, and he wanted to continue to contribute. I mean, he was a trained engineer, and his engineering work was very important to him. So it was clear after a few months of coming back from the moon that they weren't going to let him fly into space again, and so NASA gave him a job overlooking the aeronautical programs. But instead of letting him really do the job, he was always being called over for photo shoots and signing autographs, and they just really weren't letting him do the job from his office in Washington, D.C. So he decided, I'm not going to keep putting up with that. He decided, well, I'm going to move back to Ohio, which he did, and he became a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of Cincinnati. And so, again, that was his effort to sort of get out of, he wanted to continue to contribute and keep his family and his own life as normal as possible. But even as a professor of aerospace engineering at a Midwestern university, he was still first man on the moon, and there were still all kinds of demands and pressures. And I've looked at all of his, at Purdue University, where Armstrong's papers are kept, There's about 100,000 letters, fan mail letters to him, which I've looked at almost. I've looked at almost every one of them, and the demands on him. I mean, not people wanting photos and signatures and appearances and, you know, answers. And I mean, they just wanted so much from him, and Neil did what he could to, you know, to give people what they wanted. But, you know, no person would ever, you know, in those situations, are able to, you know, to give society everything they want and still try to lead a normal life.
And, Jim, what do you hope people take away from reading your book, First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong? And they can buy it right at any bookstore or through Amazon or whatever.
Oh, sure. Both Amazon and most of the major bookstores. I think a couple things. One, with this anniversary coming up, I think it's, you know, people, unless you're about 60 years old, you know, this, you know, the first mission would be, well, 50 year anniversary in July. So, you know, unless you were 10 years old or about 10 at the time, you probably didn't have very clear recollection of what was going on. So you almost have to be 60 years old to really remember much about Apollo 11. So this is an opportunity for, you know, probably what amounts to about 80% of the world's population who wasn't around in 1969 to actually understand better what this took. I mean, this was not easy. This was hard, as President Kennedy said. And so I think just being able to, you know, to rediscover the endeavor, the drive, the commitment, the loss, the risk that was involved in the Apollo 11 mission. I mean, that's important, I think, at this point in time.
It makes
and then
you
the second
proud,
thing,
very proud of what happened.
Yeah, very proud. And then secondly, I would say, you know, Armstrong for most people is just this iconic figure that walks down the ladder and steps on the moon and says one small step, and they don't know much more besides that. Neil was a very ordinary human being in a lot of ways, and what my book tries to do is present him in a very three-dimensional way so you understand him not just as an icon, but as one of us.
James R. Hansen, author of First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, published by Simon & Schuster and co-producer of the recent motion picture of the same title, In Conversation with Carol Marx. And that about does it for this installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. Thank you, Carol Marx, our host and founder. Thank you, Dwayne Doobie Jr., our producer on the front line. Thanks to all our affiliates. On behalf of all of us here at A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend for another installment of the talk show for grown-ups.